It's time for Twig. This week in Google, Jeff and Gina are here. We're going to talk about Google I.O., what kinds of things we can expect, including a new Android TV, those self-driving cars, and a whole lot more, including our Google changelog. It's all coming up next. Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 252, recorded June 4th, 2014. Pretty damn intuitive. This Week in Google is brought to you by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom's not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWIG to receive $10 off at checkout. And by Lantronics, maker of the XPrint server. Print from any Android phone, tablet, Chromebook, or Kindle Fire to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter the offer code TWIT to receive free shipping on your order. And by Full Sail University. Full Sail offers both online and campus degree programs centered on real-world experience in the entertainment, media, and technology industries. For more information, visit fullsail.edu/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the Sleepy Eye edition. Sleepy-eyed in Germany, it's Mr. Jeff Jarvis of the City University of New York. Actually, he looks like an Eminence Gris. You look very serious in your black, with your black headphones.
I did just get out of the sauna, so my hair is
wet. Oh, you're relaxed now. You're relaxed.
I tried to burn the cold out of my sinuses.
Is it freezing? Oh, you have a cold. I'm sorry. Well, it's very kind of you to be with us. You're in Germany for a Google event.
A Google Big Tent event, in full disclosure, as they flew me over.
What is a Big Tent event?
It's Google trying to make nice with the world. policy, media, that kind of stuff, and they bring together panel discussions. I've been to three or four of them, and they've held them all around. And it's mainly from the international side. They've had a few in D.C., but they'll have discussions. Tomorrow it's about media and Google. And
the idea that it says on the Big Tent event page is to bring together many points of view about the impact of the internet on society.
Right.
So, Big Ten event number there are 20 events in Europe. Wow, look, they're all over.
Well, they've got a lot of them, yeah.
And you're speaking about what?
I'm doing 10 minutes on kind of Germany and media and internet.
That should be fun.
Are you going to really, really rake them over the coals?
I'll try to have a little subtlety to it.
By the way, that other voice,
subtlety.
That other voice is, of course, the great Gina Trapani of smarterware.org, thinkup.com, and host, we're very proud to say, host of All About Android on Tuesday nights on this show, along with Jason.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Welcome.
I'll try to be lively if Jeff is sleepy.
I thought we'd just do this show in a very low key. I think we should all match his energy.
All right, okay. I can match.
It's all just very relaxed.
Chill.
Here.
Just like very chill.
Yeah. Don't listen to this show while driving.
Yeah. There's a little bit going on.
You might bond.
Not really too much.
We're all members of the slow talkers of
America.
America.
That's a great Bob and Ray routine, which nobody but Jeff and I are old enough to even know who Bob and Ray are. Sad to say. We just love them. You'll be talking about go ahead.
I just appreciate making fun of slow talkers.
Yeah.
That's why I was laughing.
Yeah. I'm a close talker. He's a slow talker. Between the two of us, it's a mess. It's horrible. So, Jake, did you get a chance to watch anything of Apple's event on Monday? Because Google seemed to be the subtext there. Apple.
I have to say that I didn't catch much of it at all, and I read a few summaries afterwards, and it didn't sound like there was a whole lot there. I don't know how was Google a subtext?
A couple of ways.
You know, Apple for a while has been trying to get Google off of iOS and disintermediates Google in searches on iOS with Siri, for instance. If you search for something with Siri, even the search, the web search all done with Google is hidden from Google. Google only sees Apple. They're bringing that to the desktop. So Spotlight searches now will search everything, not just your hard drive, but search the internet for information. You will be able to
speak. Via Bing, right?
It will use Bing in some cases. It may use Google. I guess Safari will continue to use Google. But if you use the desktop Spotlight search, it'll use Bing. And even then, it will not. You won't be visible to Bing. Apple will. But it will also use Wolfram Alpha and Wikipedia and all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's very clear Apple has decided. I think Apple has decided to market itself as the antithesis to Google, the privacy and security company. And so they're offering, for instance, they're offering or plan to offer iCloud Drive, which will have roughly the same price as Google Drive. It's going to be very inexpensive, 5 gigs free. And then I think it's $1.99 a month for 100 gigs. They're going to offer App Engine style services for developers. So you could put your app on the iCloud. And it'll actually support a surprisingly large amount of data. I can't remember what they said, but it was quite a bit of data for free. It does very much feel like Apple's saying, all right, Google, take this, take that.
It certainly sounded like some of the iOS updates were very Android-y.
They're doing a lot of the things Android has been doing all along.
It's already been doing for a long time. Yeah. And DuckDuckGo is now an option for private search in Safari, right?
When you use, it's not even an option. When you use private search in Safari, it defaults to DuckDuckGo.
That's a big deal for DuckDuckGo.
Yeah, it's good. It's kind of a pat in the back for them. Apple also, they did a lot of things that Google has been doing on Android. You know, the fact that you could put in Swipe, for instance. They showed Swipe. Third-party keyboards on iOS, to me, is a big deal. That was one of the main reasons I left iOS. They're supposedly going to come out with a bigger screen iPhone this fall. And if they do, that will be two of the big reasons I left iOS. And they're offering some interesting reasons to go to iOS. For instance, their Touch ID, their fingerprint sensor on the 5S, is going to have more open API. Third parties will be able to use it, which means banking apps, LastPass, things like that might be able to use it.
That's really cool.
I think that's very cool, especially since it works so well. We were hoping they would do that.
Yeah, that's big. Yeah. That's really big.
They are going to provide a form of inter-app communications a la Android. You know, when you on Android install a new application, it's added to your share menu. It will be doing that now on iOS.
That was also a huge drawback on iOS.
Right.
Yep.
You had Twitter, Facebook, email, and that was AirDrop, and that was about it. Now you'll be able, and you'll also, as a developer, you'll be able to write extensions that will then plug into services like not just the share service. And by the way, as a developer, you'll have to explicitly plug into the share service. Your extensions are a standalone binary that are part of the installation. And I think Apple's really paying close attention to preserving security by making sure that the inter-app communications are very constrained, locked down. They encourage you in the documentation to make it look like the place you're going, not the place you've come from, things like that. I think they're actually doing it quite elegantly. And somebody said, and I'm curious what you think as a developer, Gina, and an Android user, although also used an iPhone for a long time. Mm-hmm. They said that it's easier. Somebody said that it's easier and probably more secure to go from a lockdown state to less lockdown. As Apple has done, than to go in the other direction, as Google has done or Android has done, to go from completely wide open to kind of slowly tightening down the nuts, or Microsoft slightly tightening down the nuts. That seems to make sense.
I would agree with that. Yeah. I would agree with that. It's sort of like you can lower prices, right? But you can't really raise them.
Yeah. Yes, that's a good analogy. It's
very similar.
Yeah.
This is kind of copy and paste. We're just seeing this happen over and over again where, you know, these basic functions, on iOS, you had to wait for a really long time. But when they came, they were done very well. I mean, it's almost like, you know, Android is the canary in the coal mine and Apple observes and then, you know, does their own take on it. And you know, their take on it is usually very beautiful and very functional. And, you know, they have the advantage of sort of learning from, you know, other implementations what the issues are with them.
And then they're moving into Google territory and things like home automation. You know, Google made a lot of noise about Google at Home, but never really delivered the Q guide. I should absolutely point out that everything that happened on Monday at WWDC was similar, was an announcement of something that is going to come to us. Although we have seen a developer release of iOS 8, and people will tell me that there are a lot of, you know, nice features in this implementation. It does seem to be fairly solid. But it is a case of Apple saying, well, we're going to do home automation. And that's something Google has said, too. Microsoft has been saying it for more than a decade.
Yeah. Hard Did we do. See anything at the Apple conference that makes no. you say... No.
what they do at WWDC, they didn't show any hardware at all. It's not like Google right. I/O.
They don't do that. Right.
They say you're going to get today iOS 8 pre-release, and when I say you, I mean developers. It's a developer show, and you're going to get OS 10 10.10, which they've decided to name Yosemite. You're going to get that. You can download that. You can start playing with it. Here's the specs. Here's the API. Here's some of the new features, not all, and we want you to start developing for it. But they don't say, oh, and here's our Apple at home device. Now, they do already have iBeacons, and it looks like iBeacons, which is the Bluetooth low energy, I'm here, is going to be used in a lot of interesting ways. I think what Apple said, and again, they've got to implement it, was very compelling. So much so that I have to say, I think probably come this fall, they may have eliminated reasons for me not to use an iPhone. I might look at going back to iOS for my main phone.
Interesting.
Yeah. Oh.
We'll see. They got to get a bigger screen. I can't use that four-inch screen. That's crazy. That's crazy talk. But you know, the keyboard was one of the reasons I was dying, too.
And the notification shade got better.
Yeah.
Yes?
More Android-y. Although mm-hmm. it's hard to say, what is Android's notification shade? Because of course, if you have a Nexus 5, you know what the pure version is. But every manufacturer, Samsung, HTC, LG, everybody has their own variation on this.
Right. Well, I just meant rich notifications, and that you can, yes. you know, that you can add controls like reply or tweet or skip to the next song or pause.
Those will be
whatever.
Treated, as I understand it, as extensions. So that's another kind of extension.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
And by the way, that'll go to the desktop as well. Oh, I know another thing they're going to add. Touchless voice. So you'll be able to say, and I have to say, I like this better than OK Google Now. Hey, Siri. Don't you like that?
That's it. I'm abandoning all Android, all Google products because I can say, Hey, Siri.
Yeah, it's got a little bit more book on
it. I'm not moving until you can say, Yo, Siri.
Yay, Siri. But you know what's funny is it reminds me that I almost always say, hey, Siri, anyway. So it's like the episode of Veep on Sunday two Sundays ago where he's going, hey, Siri, how many horses died in World War I? He literally said, hey, Siri. And I feel like that's what everybody does anyway. Apple's software must just be discarding the first few words.
It's a subtle difference, but Siri is a persona, whereas mm-hmm. Google is sort of just the ever-present computer. So it's interesting that you'd say, okay, Google versus hey, Siri.
Hey, Siri.
Yeah, it's more like you're addressing a person.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, if they get Scarlett Johansson's voice, it is over.
It's over. Oh, I watched her, by the way.
What do you think? Great movie.
Really enjoyed it.
Really good movie.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was compelling. It was really good.
And it raises some very interesting issues.
Yeah.
You will just buy an iPhone. You'll marry it.
Yeah. Well, I think there is those who have.
Yeah.
Hell, if you can marry a pillow in Japan, you can marry an iPhone here. Boy, that got dead silence. You can. Hello, Jason. Go ahead. Jason Howell's new desk. Is right behind your head, Jeff Jarvis. So if you see a very tall person, just slowly get your hand out of there. Jason sinks slowly in the west. We were a little concerned because at first we could see the top of his head over that partition.
That's prime real estate right there.
Lowered his chair. Oh, yeah, that's a good seat. That's the good seat.
But he can't talk on the phone while the shows are on, right?
Can you talk on the phone while the shows are on, Jason? He's not listening.
He's muted now.
He's muted. I don't know. It's a pretty directional mic. I bet he could talk like this. is.
Yeah, Mike probably wouldn't pick it up.
We have this problem in general. Everybody in the office has to kind of go in the kitchen if they want to talk on the phone. That's okay. We're a bunch of introverted nerds. Nobody wants to talk on the phone anyway.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's enough. But I just wanted to bring it up because it did feel very much like Apple was targeting Google. In a lot of the things that they were bringing to the iPhone and doing, I think, a lot of the right things to provide an alternative to Google and not copy Google, but to say, if you want these features, but you want them where your privacy is going to be kind of preserved, then we're going to provide an alternative.
But hold on there for one second. So Apple's going to hide your identity from all these services, which means you don't get the customization opportunities you want. They want A. B, who's to say we trust Apple with all this information?
Right. Well, I'm not saying one does, but if one does, then one would be happier with this.
And Apple who's to say that anyone trusts Apple can create a cloud experience that actually works?
That's a big
right? I mean, they've had a couple of big bloopers here already. You know, like, I mean, when you said App Engine on Apple, I was like, no way.
Well, but that may change if they can, you know, you're right. They haven't delivered ever. They have some horrific failures with Mobile Me and so forth. One hopes that they will do better, but it remains to be seen. They did call Android a toxic hell stew. Oh, you missed that?
I did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That, I'm surprised you didn't talk about that last night on
I had to miss last night. I'm sure, actually, they did talk. I had to miss last night. Did they say that on stage? That's amazing.
They quoted Adrian Kingsley Hughes, who is a ZDNet writer. And he says Android fragmentation, he's talking about the fragmentation, has turned devices, here's the exact quote from ZDNet, into a toxic hell stew of vulnerabilities. I completely disagree. But
okay.
But they did. Okay. They put that in quotes on a big slide on the screen.
And, wow, that's
making Adrian
that's a far
very
cry
happy.
From the days when they didn't mention their competitors. I mean, the one place where Apple has a really long way to go and a lot of work to do is the developer tools. I mean, iTunes Connect, like the app tools, the tools they give you as an app developer, mobile app developer in particular, because that's where my skills are, compared to the Play Store console. I mean, Google is far and away much kinder to developers, just in terms of stats and tools and the ways to you know see how your app is doing and improve that. I mean, you know, Apple's always had extreme empathy for users, right? And I think that Google's core competency is extreme empathy for developers, right? So like, Google makes really great tools for nerds, and you know, Apple makes really great tools for humans. But if Apple wants developers to feel better about developing for their platform and using things like their version of App Engine, and I think that they really have a lot of work to do there.
By the way, last night's episode of All About Android was titled "Swimming in a Toxic Hell Stew." It's kind of a tribute.
Clearly, yes.
So, I mean, you're a developer. You've developed for both platforms. It seems to me you have a good standing to talk about this. So, you think that that it's more pleasurable to develop for Android?
I mean, I was Android first, and I was a Java programmer before Android. So Android was a lot very attractive to me. Like, I never really got my feet with Objective-C in the way that I would have liked, or the way that I felt that I did with Android. And I was developing for Android a lot earlier, so I am certainly biased. But I do know the developer tools for Android are way better. I do know that you have to test across a lot more devices, and there are a lot more configurations to make sure that your app works on Android than iOS. So there's give and take there, right? I mean, the fragmentation issue still is an issue. But just talking about purely the tools for uploading your binary and distributing it to testers and seeing, you know, what countries your app is doing well in and how your localizations are doing and that kind of thing, Google beats Apple's tools, you know, hands down.
Actually, I think it would be fair to say that Java is a toxic hell stew. JavaScript is a toxic hell stool, but that's another... but Java and JavaScript really are somewhat of a hell stew. And in fact, Apple...
Objective-C is not much better.
Well,
honestly.
Apple responded to that, and I guess you missed it, yes. But Apple has introduced a replacement for Objective-C. They're calling it Swift. They're saying it's significantly faster than Objective-C. So that's good news. And it avoids... I think I could safely synopsize this and say what they've done is eliminated downward compatibility, eliminated all the things from C that they put in Objective-C just so it would be C-friendly.
And does this mean you have to rewrite apps now?
You do not. Objective-C is not deprecated or replaced. In fact, you can write apps in both languages at once. But the idea is it is an expressive tool for writing code for Cocoa and Cocoa Touch, that is desktop and iOS. I think it's a beautiful language, a very nice language. And they've provided something very interesting called Playgrounds, which reminds me a lot of, say, the Python interpreter, where you can go in the interpreter and try statements, try code, and see what happens. The Playground gives you a graphical interface that lets you try code. It's really a debugger because you can use a scrubber to go back and forth in your code, see how it impacts the graphical output, modify it, get instant changes. Very interesting programming language. I think developers are going to like a lot. It's not going to be hard to learn. It's C-like. But they've eliminated some of the things that made C dangerous and Objective-C dangerous. They've eliminated some of the things that you don't need anymore. And they've eliminated some of the constructs that were unsafe. It uses not strong typing. It's typed by inference. But it is fairly immutable typing. So variables are initialized, must be initialized before use. They have built-in array and integer overflow checking. Instead of garbage collection, which is what Java does, they use reference counting.
Objective-C.
Yeah, they call it ARC. I think that this might be an interesting. I'd love to get your take on it at some point. I know it's probably not high on your list, but it reminds me of Python or Ruby, which I love, these scripted languages, but has the efficiency of Objective-C because it compiles down to the LLVM. And, the benchmarks they showed were kind of, as usual, carefully chosen.
Yes, of course. I am excited about that, particularly around the tools. I think that over the last few years of all these like learning how to code tools, we've seen a lot of sort of interactive, editors, and then see, as you type, see how your code affects things. And I'd love to see those built into modern IDEs, even something as advanced as Xcode. I mean, anything that can that helps developers be more productive and not have to think about things like memory management and garbage collection, those are a good thing. It means better apps. It means faster deploys. Yeah, I'm excited about Swift. I'm definitely going to play around with it because, like I said, I never quite got into Objective-C. I always found it sort of frustrating and foreign. So, I would definitely check out Swift. I'd even rewrite my app in Swift for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it looks pretty fun. I downloaded it and started playing with it immediately because I think the. This is what's interesting about this is it's going to encourage, by the way, this is free. It's everybody who uses a Mac can use it. It's not cross-platform. Objective-C was cross-platform. It's not cross-platform. This is Apple only. But they offer free documentation. It's $99 to become an Apple developer, and then you get access to a ton of stuff.
Well, stay on that for a second. It's never been easy to write apps for both platforms. Does this make it yet harder?
Yes. Absolutely. If you start writing in Swift, you're not writing cross-platform. You're writing to the hardware.
Right, but if you're writing in Objective-C, you're also writing for the platform, too. I mean, Objective-C, you could write on other platforms, but it's kind of like Java now. Really, people are building Android apps in Java, right? Like, theoretically, sure, there are other things you can write Java for, but
when you
particularly the Android SDK or the whole set of Android-specific classes, that's Android only. And there are some frameworks that help you, build an app and then deploy to native code on both platforms. I don't know how good they are, but there are people out there trying to solve that problem. But Apple's not going to solve that problem.
You have to do it at a very high level. And games, there's Unity and there's other things that let you do that. But if you want to, it's always been the case. I'm sure with todo.txt, you didn't have share any or much code.
No. I mean, the design pattern, sure, like the objects and things, but no, there's no shared code.
This lends itself, by the way, very well to design patterns. A lot of the things they've done it's fairly modern. But, as people in the chat room are saying, Go is just as modern. Java has fixed many of these problems. Apple has no interest in being cross-platform.
No.
Right. Yeah.
And they're
making
it's
not in their interest.
Yeah, it's not in their interest. Microsoft is interesting. Microsoft is a little more open to that notion. But Apple's saying, this is for writing for our stuff.
Yeah. I think it was Farhad Manju who was asking, why why are companies building new programming languages right now? It happens not as often as, platforms or apps, but it is interesting to see like Go and Swift and new languages emerge. Because at some point you say, like, haven't we figured out every way to express a certain thing? But I just think requirements change and different kinds of hardware change and the problems become a little more common. And I think certain languages handle them a little better.
Right. I think also the fads and trends in programming, things like design patterns, often lend it themselves better to new languages and old languages. And people write the languages around the trends in programming. And I think Go is a good example of that. I'm sure Swift is as well. You will like it that, remember, I don't know if you remember this, but Apple bought a company called TestFlight a few months ago. Developers were very disappointed because they used TestFlight to beta test apps for iOS. Apple bought them, and the good news is they have immediately made it available even under the same name, TestFlight. So now you can have 1,000 beta testers instead of 100 on your iOS app. The process is easier. You get a lot. It's much easier to get feedback and so forth. So that's also
TestFlight was a godsend. Yeah. I used TestFlight to do text. I literally could not figure out how to have people beta test my. You know, with Android, you like email the APK.
Say, here's the file. Whatever you want. Install it.
Here's the file. Right. Install it. Like, okay, maybe you have to uncheck allow unknown sources in Android, right?
Right.
But with an iOS app, it's a whole rigmarole. You have to get the device ID and allocate license. I didn't even understand. I went through the steps. I went through the 26 steps that it took to do it. In the end, I didn't really know what I did, and I just sort of, prayed, and it worked. But TestFlight made that a lot easier. Still, TestFlight was a pain. You had to ask people to join TestFlight and add their device, and then you could issue them. Anyway, this is kind of what I was talking about, and this is just about the issue of having your app distributed only through the App Store and right. approval and all that stuff. So the TestFlight acquisition was certainly a step in the right direction, and TestFlight is great, but it's solving a problem that just doesn't exist in the Play Store.
Yeah, it's a problem Apple created, really.
Right. It's a problem that they created, exactly.
To jailbreak an iPhone requires all sorts of maneuvers and hoops you have to jump through, and you can't do it with current versions of iOS, et cetera, et cetera. To jailbreak an Android phone, you just go into settings and you check the box that says allow third-party apps, and that's it. You're done.
Right, to sideload, yeah.
That's all jailbreaking does on iOS, and which is kind of says something, that people make it's such a big deal to do that. So, I think I said this on Monday. There is still a very big gulf between proprietary and open, and there are advantages to being proprietary. In Germany, the trains ran on time under Mussolini. Oh, that was Italy. But sometimes fascism benefits. I think generally I come down on the side of openness.
Yeah.
A little more chaos.
Chaos. It's chaotic. It's a toxic hell stew, and we like it.
There we got a title. We might have to steal it.
We like it. All right, we're going to take a break, come back with more. Jeff Jarvis, poor guy. He just got out of the sauna. His brain is bubbling still. A Wiener Schnitzel in a sauna. That's a recipe for disaster.
Not bad, huh?
He's barely moving. Gina Trepan, do you have a cold? Are you a little under the weather too? Oh my God. It's the walking wounded here. Well, I'm feeling pretty good.
I had nothing to say about Apple development. So
no, I guess you're probably right. Yeah,
finally, right. I'm tired and you're talking about Apple stuff. Gina gets a word in edgewise finally on the show.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, it's good. It's good. And by the way, Ben tells me in Germany the trains never run on time.
They don't. No, the Germans complain mightily about their trains.
Well, look, they don't now. That's the point. I'll move on. We're gonna take a break. I don't want to go too down this road. We're gonna take a break and come back in a moment with more. We're talking about. In fact, we'll get our Google changelog in here. Let Jeff take a little bit longer nap. Our show brought to you today by our friends at LegalZoom.com, and not a law firm. It provides self-help services so that you can get legal work done without paying a high price for a fancy lawyer. LegalZoom.com. Turns out a lot of the legal stuff you do, including forming a business, can be done easily without a lawyer. America was built by innovators and dreamers. Man, we are in an age of innovation. And that's really exciting. It's what makes this country work, and actually, let's say, the whole world work. We're in an exciting time. LegalZoom is celebrating this month. I think it's like National Start Your Own Business Month or something like that, with a deal to help you start your own business, to launch your dream. Whether it's applying for a patent to secure your invention, registering your trademark to protect your products, your services, your brand, or incorporation, or forming an LLC to launch your business, LegalZoom can do it for you at an amazing price. Look at that, $99 to start an LLC or a Chapter S or C corporation. That's what we did, $99. We're still using those LLC papers, the operating agreement I created in 2005. Over 1 million businesses have gotten off started off on the right foot with LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom has received an A+ from the Better Business Bureau. I'm not surprised. Celebrate innovation with LegalZoom today and get a special price on trademark, copyright, or provisional patent applications. All you have to do is use the offer code TWIG at checkout. We'll give you $10 off. LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help services. They're not a law firm. By the way, if you do want legal advice from an attorney, you can get it at a much more affordable price. They've pre-negotiated monthly flat rate pricing with attorneys in every state. You can go on to LegalZoom.com, find an attorney profile, read unedited reviews, choose the attorney you need, and then ask them things like, well, should I be a Chapter S, a Chapter C? Should I be an LLC? Could I be a nonprofit? Those are the kinds of things an attorney is very useful for. And then you fill out the forms on LegalZoom.com. I love it. Get started today. LegalZoom.com. Use the offer code TWIG. Get $10 off at checkout. We thank LegalZoom for their support, not only of This Week in Google, but really for making TWIT happen. LegalZoom.com. Time, ladies and gentlemen, for the Google Changelog.
The Google Changelog.
This is where we, as in Gina Trapani, give you all the things that have changed at Google this week.
You can tell it's the month of Google I.O. because there's a lot going on. Mm. So let's see if I can punch through this. So I guess the big announcement this month is that Google announced that they're working on a new Chrome extension called End-to-End, which kind of sounds dirty, but it's not. It streamlines the
process. It sounds like the last episode of Silicon Valley, if we're going to be perfectly honest. Oh, well, that was middle to middle.
Middle to middle.
Okay. Different kind of encryption.
Different kind of encryption. Yeah. This Chrome extension streamlines the process of using PGP to encrypt your email when you're using Gmail. So this extension actually hasn't been released yet. Google just released the code for review by the community. They want to make sure that it's as secure as it absolutely should be. So it's up on code.google.com. You can check it out. It's a Chrome extension, so it's basically
very
JavaScript.
Early. It's not in the extension store because it's really, they want to have people look at it and bang on it.
Right, and this is something that we've talked about on the show a bunch of times. You know, what are the implications of if your content is encrypted in your browser and sent via Gmail to someone else, and they decrypt it on their client, Gmail doesn't see the content. They can't advertise to you against a bunch of jumbled letters, right? So this is Google at their best. I mean, I feel like this is Google really not being evil, and I'm excited. I hope that this extension works well. I hope it supports other web mail providers than just Gmail.
They say it will.
And that's an ambitious
goal.
It's
JavaScript, which is great. It uses a JavaScript OpenPGP library. So it's open. It's mm-hmm. open source. You can look at the source because it's JavaScript. And it will work anywhere because it's built-in encryption. This is exciting. I think this is really the best. I'm thrilled that Google's are doing this. I think their attitude is, well, most people won't do it all the time, so it's not a big deal.
Right.
I guess.
I don't think it's going to be on by default. I think that you're going to have to, say I'm sending an email I care about and encrypt this. And hopefully it'll be a button. It'll be that easy. What else we got? Okay, Chromecast. A few new Chromecast-enabled apps. The Watch ESPN app, the sports fan of my house was very excited about this. Watch ESPN app is now Chromecast-enabled. You can also
just
watch me.
Just in time for the World Cup.
Yes.
Yay.
Major League Soccer via the MLS Match Day app and MLS Live. Those are premium services. The Crunchyroll video service, which has a bunch of TV and video content, also now Chromecast enabled. And you can also stream your photos and videos in the Google Plus app to the Chromecast. So you can enable that feature. You tap the cast button and the photos view of the Google Plus app on iOS or Android. Yeah, that's nice. A good one. That's a good one. I wanted to see pictures of my kid that my wife took all day while I was at work at the end of the day.
All the time. And if you see something cool, you can say, hey, you know, let me show you this. That's great. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Really nice. What else we got? Oh, Google launches a 64-bit version of Chrome, starting with the Dev and Canary channels. And this is for Windows 7 and Windows 8. So in both cases, the 64-bit version is offered by default if you're running the 64-bit flavor of Windows. The 32-bit version, of course, is still available. And the reason why they're building the 64-bit version is it's just better. Better speed, better security, better stability for 64-bit Windows users. The Google Plus app for iOS is playing a little catch up with Android. It just got updated with the Stories, which came out for Android a couple weeks ago, and photo filters. So you can download that now on devices running iOS 6.0 or later. That's the really cool feature that kind of takes your photos and figures out where you were and makes this sort of story that you can page through and see where you went. And I think, Leo, you demoed a story that you made from one of your trips and your pictures.
Love it.
Really cool feature.
Yeah.
Really cool feature. So iOS users get that now. Yeah. Automatically, which is awesome. Let's see. Google's adding a one-click Hangout button that you can add anywhere on any web page, any app. It's basically a start button for starting Hangouts, and they're targeting, it seems like, companies, enterprise customers who want to offer customer service Hangouts or job interviews or instant meetings and their apps. It's already been available to select Google Enterprise customers that and they've used it in a bunch of ways, including embedding it into online collaboration files, customer support apps and sales apps, and interacting with job candidates. So now it's become available to everyone. So the button's super customizable. You can render it in markup, HTML5, JavaScript. It's available in many languages. So you can basically just kick off a Hangout from anywhere. Finally, earlier this week, and I'm sure my co-host talked about this last night on All About Android, Google posted factory images for the latest build of Android 4.4.3, and the update is starting to roll out to Google Experience Android devices. One of the updates, I think this is a pretty light update, but one of the updates includes a refreshed design of the dialer app. So you got a new color scheme, blue, black, gray, and white, and the action bar went from gray to blue. And I think that this is the kind of design refresh we're going to see across a bunch of Google apps at I.O. later on this month. So I think we're going to see more of this. And that's all I got.
And that's the Google Changelog. I'm excited about the encryption. I think it's going to be a big... big deal, because you can do it now, but you have to install a plugin, and it's just not easy. It's not for the everyday person.
And and it puts pressure on other web mail providers. And I actually didn't include this in this bit of the story, but as part of this announcement about the end-to-end, Google published this transparency report about which web mail providers support which kinds of encryptions. And it's kind of like public shaming, you know, as a way to get more providers to support TLS and other kinds of encryption. So
show the screen if you can, Chad. I don't know if you have my screen. There it is. How much email was encrypted in transit? Coming from Google... 69% of messages from Gmail to other providers were encrypted. That's great. That's in the last 30 days. The last year, you can see it started sometime between October and January of 2013, 2014. But that's a good number. But then if you look at messages coming from other providers, less than half is encrypted on its way to Google. And the reason that's important is you might say, well, I have an encrypted connection to Google and nobody can read my email as I compose it and upload it to Google, but the minute it goes off of Google's servers, it's transported across the public internet. And, it's in many cases not encrypted. Both sides have to agree to encryption. Google obviously does offer that in its SMTP client. I guess, what do they use? Are they using SMTP? I don't even know what they use. But many, many providers don't. So it is public shaming. It's saying, in fact, they even have a little ad. Let's make email safer. And if you go to, have you gone to this URL, g.co/safer email, you can see how safe yours is. And then they have a list of email encrypted and so forth. This is a good, it is the right answer. And it's not encrypted because it wasn't originally intended to be encrypted. Nobody thought email should be encrypted. It's only now that we want to do it.
Right.
Thanks to Edward Snowden. I'm just going to type in that.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. We hear you now.
My other headset, conked out.
Oh, I thought you bought a new one just for this show.
That was actually my.
I did.
I had you muted.
Oh, was your fault?
Yeah, during the ad, I muted you because of the headset rustle. But right now, we're not getting your video.
Aw.
He turned out the lights.
Sorry.
I feel like Jeff jumps, like leaps tall buildings in order to do the show. I
know,
appreciate
he really
it so
does.
Much.
He does.
I will. I'm gonna hang up and come back. Okay?
Okay. We'll get you back in a minute, Jeff. Google has a very good page. If you go to this Google Transparency Report, again, g.co/safer email, and you go to the bottom, there's a really good page on how encryption works that explains why this is an issue, why you should... you know, encourage this kind of encryption from your email provider and so forth. And it's using TLS, and it's just...
TLS,
it means
right.
You got to use TLS from your server to their server, and you have to support TLS. TLS is SSL. It's the same thing we use to encrypt our transactions to our bank and Amazon and so forth.
Right. It's the difference between sending, I think this is the analogy they use, sending a postcard versus sending a letter and an envelope, right? It's not foolproof. Someone could certainly rip open the envelope, right? But it's the difference between sending it in the clear.
They have two beautiful illustrations, one with the postcard and all the bad guys who are snooping on your postcard, and then with an encrypted pipe, and those bad guys just can't see into it. And that's what
and one other advantage of this kind of encryption is that the argument before was that if you... only the people who used encryption were doing suspicious things.
Right.
The more people use encryption, the less those who use encryption will look suspicious.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. In fact, it's why I started using PGP and then later OpenPGP, because I wanted to kind of establish a baseline of encryption. Everybody should be encrypting all the time. It's not a tacit admission of guilt. So... there was a funny post on Google Plus this week, right after WWDC. He said, Google announces it's going to spend $1 billion to buy low-altitude satellites to provide internet to the entire world and gets no attention. Apple announces a font change, and everybody's going, ooh, ah! And I think this might be the underreported story of the year to this point.
Yep.
And it's an amazing thing. And I have buried the lead. Google has said they are spending more than $1 billion to put up their own satellites, a fleet of satellites, low orbit satellites, that will bring the internet to unwired regions of the globe, especially to underdeveloped nations, people who have financial and technical reasons they can't get the internet. This is being led by Greg Weiler, who's the founder of Orb Networks, a satellite communications startup. They've been hiring engineers to work on the project. They've allocated $1 billion, maybe as much as $3 billion to do it.
Now, is this satellites or balloons or drones?
This is not loons. This is not drones. This is satellites, something a little more... dare I say down to earth? a little more stable, that's right. So it was something better understood.
With more latency.
But I think that the feeling is if you've got no internet, a little latency is better.
You'll take what you can get.
Yeah. You may remember that Craig McCaw, who created cell phones, basically, with Cellular One, who really put it on the map, and Bill Gates founded a company called Teledesic more than 20 years ago to do the same thing, to put LEOs, low Earth orbit satellites, for internet service. That thing was a $9 billion project that basically flopped. They stopped doing it in 2002. You also may remember Iridium, which was a satellite phone service using low Earth orbit satellites that went into bankruptcy in 1999. So... this is something that's been tried before, but it seems to me that Google has the best shot at it. These are 1,500-pound satellites, and they I'm sorry, I take it back. These are 250-pound satellites. They're a lot smaller than the traditional 1,500-pound satellites, and they want to circle the globe with them, which is quite amazing. 160 satellites. It really could actually solve this problem in such an interesting way. You've got to get
and
regulatory.
Facebook's talking about the same thing, you know, and their
with
drones,
drones
and stuff. But it just the business sense, the business case for Google just makes more sense to me.
Right. They also say that they think that they can make ground antenna systems much more inexpensive. I mean, traditionally, they cost lots of money to get the receive. We're talking hundreds of dollars instead of millions. I think this is really
Here's my other question. Can governments interfere with this?
Yes, they have to. I mean, that's the problem. You're going to float a satellite or two or three over every nation in the world. You're going to have some issues. So there is absolutely there's regulatory issues and so forth. But there would be with balloons. there would be
right,
with
it
drones.
It wouldn't matter what they were. It wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
A fleet of pigeons.
I think these are geostationary, but I'm not sure. No, they're just low Earth orbit.
Why are there regulatory? Let me just understand. The satellite goes straight to your phone, or the satellite goes to a ground receiving station to your phone?
I'm sure it's not straight to your phone, but I don't know.
Okay, so that's why you have government, right?
Right.
So what they're eliminating is the line to the pop.
Right. Right. Google has Sherlocked Loon, says USC Waller in our chat room. And only a bunch of geeks would even understand what that sentence means. very interesting. I mean, really interesting. But, I mean, there's a long way to go still. But clearly Google has you know, placed a bet here. They've hired between 10 and 20 people. And they're reporting to Craig Barrett, who reports to Larry Page.
Seems like money well spent and money more sensibly spent than a lot of their Google X stuff, right? I mean, it makes complete total sense, right?
Well, it's good for Google. It's good for the world.
It's good for the world, right? It makes them look, I mean, it's a win-win all the way.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what we're going to expect from Google I.O. Because now that we've seen Apple, we've got the E3 gaming conference next week. Amazon has just announced it's going to do something in the third week of June. This is a crazy month, but Google wraps it up with Google I.O., You're both coming out for it. We'll be covering it, of course, the keynotes. What are we going to see? How does Google respond to Apple? Can they top Apple? It's always risky being the first. Before we do, though, I want to show you something Google did that's so cool. And you really should be able to take advantage of it. I think it started when they did Chromebooks. They said, you know, we've got to get a way to print from a device that is not hooked up to a printer that is traveling all around. Maybe our Android device is the same thing. They created Google Cloud Print, which is a very nice solution. Easy to set up, easy to use. And if your printer supports it, it's a snap. But what if your printer doesn't? Are you going to buy a new printer just to print from your Android device? I can print from here to my printer at home over the internet using Cloud Print. And this is the first and only print server officially certified by Google for cloud printing. You see, it says right there, the made for cloud print.
I got to get one of those because I got the call. I think I told you guys, I gave my wife the Chromebook, the Pixel.
Yeah.
And she loved it.
Awesome.
And she used it without any questions or any complaints for many months.
Yeah.
But just a couple weeks ago, I got the call. She said, I need to print.
How do I print?
How do I print?
How do I print?
And I said, can't you just plug the printer? And she's like,
No.
Do you have a cloud print? I was like, no.
Well, so almost any printer will work with this. So I have more than 4,000 top brand printers. And you know what's nice about it? There's no software to install. There's nothing to do. You literally, this is it. It's a small little device. It's about the size of a power brick for a laptop. On one side, there's Ethernet, power, USB, and that's about it. What you'll do when you open it up, you plug it in, and it automatically sees all the printers on the network. If you have printers that need to be connected via USB, you can do that directly, of course. It supports multiple printers, virtually unlimited Android devices. allows USB printers to be shared all over the network, turns any printer, almost any printer, I mean, it may not work with your Epson MX100 dot matrix printer, but almost any other printer, into a cloud print compatible printer. Such a good idea. And we've seen, you know, they made one for AirPrint too that we advertised for a long time. And we got lots of emails from people saying, I can't believe how easy this was to set up. People in schools and so forth use it. It makes it very easy to make your network cloud print compatible. So I want you to try it. It's $149.95. For that, you get up to 10 network printers and 8 USB printers simultaneously. So it's more than just a household device. This every office, every business should have this. Every school. Visit xprintserver.com/twit to find out more. I didn't mention the name, did I? It's from a company called Lantronics. It's the XPrint Server Cloud Print Edition. $150. xprintserver.com/twit. If you do use the offer code twit, you'll get free shipping. You'll get it quickly. And it's in a little weird because it requires so little configuration. It's one of those things where people go, that's it? Yeah, that's it. They should actually add some steps just to make people feel better. That's it? It's working? Yeah. Oh.
There is no step three.
There is no step three. It's awesome. XPrint Server.
When you first advertised this, Leo, I ordered while you were still doing the commercial.
Oh, have you set it up yet?
No.
All right. You got to do that when you get home. And do a little demo for us on the show.
We and love print it. From the tent.
Well, as I think I mentioned, I have a Macintosh now that is nothing but a Google Cloud Print server.
Oh, because it's sharing the printer, and then you go to that's a pain.
Yeah, so now I can get rid of that.
You don't have to keep that Mac on all day,
right?
I love it. It's a really great idea. xprintserver.com/twit. Google, according to GigaOm, will be announcing its Android TV, the successor to Google TV. I loved Google TV. Apparently, it was kind of a flop. Of course, we know the Q was a flop, announced 2 years at a Google I.O. Google is about to open another front in the war for your living room, writes Janko Reckers. Company set to announce the launch of Android TV at I.O. in June, according to sources, multiple sources familiar with Google's plans. But what is Android TV? Well, it's not a device. It is a platform that others can build a device to. Actually, that happened with Google TV too, didn't it? Didn't LG and others say we're going to use Google TV on our TVs?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what this is new. According to this article,
it's too late because everybody has smart TV platforms of their own.
Yeah, and you know that's a bad thing because it means as a developer of apps, you have to develop one for LG, one for Android, Samsung, one for. I mean, it's crazy for Hisense. So one system would be very nice. The company is calling this technology that they're using Pano, P-A-N-O, and it's kind of like zero config for apps. So apps can surface individual pieces of content right on the home screen in a card-like fashion so users can browse movies, TV shows, and other types of media as soon as they turn on Android TV. Content is in a card. This is Google loves cards, right? Google Now.
Yeah, Google's all about the cards.
They can be browsed horizontally. Each movie or TV episode has deep links into the publisher's apps, giving users the option to start playback right away. So there'll be, I gather from this, an overall interface that knows about the apps but focuses on the content. That's what you want, isn't it? You don't want to have to go, well, let me see. Is it Hulu Plus or HBO Go? Let's go to HBO Go. It's not in there. Is it in... What you want is you want to see all the shows. And then you say, I want to watch that show. And then you say, okay, well, there's three ways to watch it. Doesn't that seem sensible?
That's got to be the key, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like this is just new interface. And it sounds like there's an emphasis on gaming, which makes a lot of sense because Google's really been pushing hard on giving the developers more tools for gaming, for building games. And gaming is something that Chromecast can't do. I mean, I can't really get my head around why you'd have the Chromecast, which is so great and so successful, and this. I mean, it seems like that's, you know, just more power and a better interface is what this Android TV would get you.
So according to Janko, there are two answers to that question. One is strategic and one is political. At Google I.O., he says, you're likely going to hear the strategic one, which goes a bit like this. Chromecast is a great, inexpensive device for consumers that want to use their mobile devices to launch content, right? But due to its aggressively priced limited hardware, it can't do everything you'd like to do, in particular You nailed it. Gaming. So it would make sense to have a second device that's more powerful that isn't $35, is maybe $100 that can play games like the Amazon Fire TV, right? Or, as Janko says, an Ouya done right. So that's the strategic reason. The political reason, according to Janko, is really about corporate politics. Google TV launched in 2010 as a new product based on Android, but beyond that, didn't share a whole lot with the company's Android team. Google TV was based on Honeycomb, and it was a separate team that wasn't the Android team. Janko says, I've been told by sources familiar with these discussions there was some growing discontent between the Android team and the Google TV team as Google TV floundered. So the Android team said, well, we're going to do it right. And that was the Nexus Q, which, of course, was instantly killed. But
Right, and the Nexus Q surprised the Google TV team.
Right.
I don't know if you guys remember. The Google TV team had no idea that the Q was happening. And I think that they were dismayed and surprised.
Yeah, I think they probably said, what the hell?
Well, it's a little bit like, one hand's not talking to the other. Right. I mean, Honeycomb always felt like this redheaded stepchild of a forked branch that they just sort of rushed to production in order to get into tablets faster. And the whole splitting off the team, this feels like mismanagement.
The more I hear about Google, the more it is silos. Eric Schmidt said long ago, the biggest problem facing Google is when it becomes this big. And that's the problem that faces it today. It's gigantic.
It feels like it's a side effect of a positive intention, which is to kind of maintain the startup mentality. So by making small teams. Autonomous teams, the advantage is they all are running and gunning, but the disadvantage is they're not all running and gunning in the same direction.
And, the advantage, too, is that they can kill stuff off that's not working. The Wave team, for example, was totally separate, particularly geographically. They were in Sydney, but they were completely separate. They were their own startup. They had incentives built around user acquisition that were separate from the rest of the company. And the idea was, if you don't meet your goals, then we kill the product, right? And that's what happened with the Q, and it's what happened with Google TV. It's just, it's hard, as consumers and developers to be like, oh, this feels like the same thing with maybe a different interface. How is this going to be different this time? What did you learn? And I think what you said, Leo, is true. I just realized that I'm missing the new season of Louie. I had no idea it was airing. And I wound up actually just buying it off the Play Store and using it on the Chromecast, which was a really nice experience.
It is, but it's
true. I just want to fire up my Android TV and say, hey, Google knows that I watch Louie and that I love Louie, and that as soon as the premiere happens, I'm going to want to know about it. And it should just show me.
Right.
And I'll buy it from wherever. I don't care.
Content first. We are interested in content. We don't care about HBO or Showtime or anything. We want content.
Yeah, so if Android TV has my Google Now, the knowledge that Google Now has about what TV shows I like, because Google Now is incredibly good at telling me that my favorite show has a new episode, because I tend to Google a lot while I'm watching TV. I look up stars, I look up whatever, plots, whatever. If Android TV has that, that's going to be awesome. I'm going to be able to turn that thing on, and without my DVR, have plenty of content that I'm going to want to watch, right, without having to remember to schedule or, have a backlog or whatever. I'll just be able to stream. And that would be a great experience.
And, of course, Google's changed because Andy Rubin's gone. Sundar Pichai is now in charge of both things, right? So I feel like that some of the silos are also – walls have been broken down. Which means, you can have both Chromecast and Android TV. I'm sorry, Jeff, go ahead.
I forget what I was going to say.
I think you can mismanage silos and you can mismanage a monolith, right? Mismanagement can happen either way. And it does feel like this was mismanagement, but this is Google's way, right? They build stuff. A lot of it fails. A lot of it is wildly successful. They don't know what's going to stick, and they kill, and they fail fast, and then they start a new thing. And, so while things like the Nexus Q feel like this terrible PR, blemish, it's actually just the way that it works for them product-wise.
So
no customer ever bought one, so nobody was the worse off.
Right.
Right.
A lot of people got free ones.
It just means, a lot of nerdy jerks make snarky remarks around Google I.O., but I think that they can afford that.
Oh, it looks like another Q.
Yeah, next Q, Death Star.
That's me. Anyway, so that's something to look for. Now, it remains to be seen whether there's a standalone box like a Roku box or it's just a platform that they sell to TV manufacturers that they put in. I would like to see that. God, that's apps on TVs. Even within the Samsung line, I have different experiences. You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
It's really a mess. And these guys are not good at developing apps. They shouldn't be in this business.
The other thing, and now I remember what I was going to say. The Knight Foundation held a meeting at my school a month or so ago, trying to kind of save public television. The young people in the room said, why? but the thing that struck, and that I've quoted since, is that they all said the big screen on the wall, that's the second screen.
Yes.
I'm most engaged with the screen that's right in front of me, and that's also right. The TV is running in the background. Oh, I'll watch that for a while. Okay, fine. Or maybe talk about it for a while or not. And I think that if you look at that way, how you tie the presumption was everything had to get to the big screen because that was Valhalla. No, not necessarily. And the more you can tie what you're doing on the big screen to your truly engaged smaller screen, that's where there's going to be something here. Google loves signals. Knowing what you watch, so as Gina said, they can give you the cards to say your favorite thing is coming on, and here's some more, and here's where you can find it.
I see you're That's watching TV. Fine. Would you like me to help you?
Yes.
Clippy for your TV.
I get that all the time. Ah, I see a Panasonic TV is on and on the network. What are you watching? Press this button.
Would you like me to send this self-driving car with some cheese doodles to your home?
Yes!
And I'll use the automatic lock to unlock your house and let the robot in?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll just put it on the counter. You don't have to get up. will we see? Now, Apple let the iWatch stay fallow on the back burner. No mention at all. Yep. So this is an opportunity for Google once again to start talking wearables.
But here, too, Google's been talking the OS, not the hardware.
Yeah, I think that's smart. Be the platform, not the solution.
Do you think they'll ever have their own hardware?
Yeah.
Their showcase?
They seem to always, for some reason, that I don't really understand, Google does like to build hardware. I think a lot of times, though, it's like the Pixel, their reference applications, right? The Pixel was not a product.
You want to make it work on a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, just so that people, real enthusiasts and Googlers, can use it.
So
right?
So how big will Glass be at I.O. this year?
Oh.
Good question.
I mean, my instinct says not big based on the merits, but they are behind this thing.
And they're pushing out updates like gangbusters.
Are they?
They are. They
well,
are.
That's interesting. I mean, that's the kind of thing you do before an event.
Yes, yes. One of the more interesting ones is this notification. I think it's called notification glance. So if you get the notification sound and you glance up, it will wake the device and show it to you.
Oh, I love
when
that.
You look down. And it's kind of like, that's cool. come on.
Does it kill the battery? Because it's got to be watching you all the time.
That's a good question.
How do it know you looked
that's
up?
That's definitely
it must
one
be
of the challenges.
Yeah, it must always be on.
Yeah, yeah. Some part of it, right, has to be detecting that, but... Yeah, I mean, the Moto X found a way around. I mean, you know, the always listening, always watching. You know, this is one of the challenges.
Well, the key is, it's only when you get of course, what Gina just said, I'm guessing here. It's when you get an update. Maybe it goes on a little bit right then.
Yeah, right. So you get the notification sound, you glance up, and you glance down.
I would like to run this at Google I.O. It's glasshole.sh. It's a little bash script that looks for any Google Glass attached to the local network and boots them.
What an ass.
And then it puts up glass hole discovered, deauthorizing. So it will kick glass.
Talk about violating somebody's space and somebody's privacy. This jerk is the one who's doing it. Just because I have my glass on doesn't mean I want to photograph you, whoever you are, you egotistical piece of...
So I think one thing we're going to be seeing at Google I.O. is a little fist fight between Jeff and Julian Oliver, author of Glasshole.sh.
I hear you, Jeff, but if you are the system, if you're the network administrator, you can kick any device off of the network, right? I mean, but I agree. It's the same as whatever, walking into a bar with a universal remote that shuts off all the TVs and, you know.
Which I hate. Or the argument has been for some time that way back when the theaters were going to block cell phones and pagers. Remember those? Well, what if there's a surgeon in the audience? He needs this.
But nobody uses glass for emergency communications.
No, but what if somebody's in the theater and using glass to get subtitles or something?
Right.
You know, I don't know. It's just a jerky thing to do to say, I don't like that technology, so I'm going to ban it, and I'm so friggin' clever. No, you're not, jerk.
Glass still works without Wi-Fi, though. I mean, you can still use a data program.
Right.
Your data connection.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this. There are scenarios where you would like to say this is off the record.
Well, fine. You're going to see the person wearing this ridiculously huge thing, even if it's designed by Diane von Furstenberg.
So you could then say to them, could you please take off your glass?
You know what, Leo? Even without glass, I have things called eyes and ears and a memory. And you know, you have to tell somebody something's off the record based on that. The technology.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between Mitt Romney telling his prospective voters in a private session, 40% of all the electorate is freeloading losers, and then somebody repeating that.
Somebody did.
And then somebody having a video of it. There's a big difference.
Yeah, and I think it's all the better if they have the video.
I guess.
I wouldn't hang your hat on that one, Leo, because that's a public official.
So it was okay to record that because he's a public official, even though it's a private meeting. Like, if I'm a public official, anything I do ever can be recorded and put on the internet?
Depends on whether it has newsworthy value. Yeah.
I don't know if I want to live in that world.
If a candidate for president of the United States calls 40% of the country lazy oafs, that's newsworthy, period. And again, same thing, is somebody in that room hears him say it and comes out and says, you're not going to believe what he said. And they report that. As a journalist, I support that openness. If you happen to also record it, bonus points. That's all.
Did you know? I know. Here's one you're going to love then. Using Google Glass to shoot guns around corners. This is a program called Tracking Point that turns Google Glass into a remote sight for aiming around corners. So here's a guy. He wore glass. He basically used glass to take a video of what he's going to shoot at and then aims around the corner using some
software. Of course,
he
could also put a monitor on his gun and look at that.
It's dumb.
Yeah.
And this almost feels like it's intent. It's like agitprop. Like somebody who doesn't like glass made this.
Yeah. Like, look, glass kills.
To scare people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that how you say it, Jeff? Agitprop?
Yeah, I think so.
Agitprop? It's probably some Germanic pronunciation for it, but. This will get those liberals scared.
Right. It's like, and surgeons also use it to save lives, right? Like, it's just a tool. Yeah, right. You can use it lots of different ways.
Glass is really, I have to say, has been a wonderful magnet for stories, and that's a good reason I like it.
It has.
Diane von Furstenberg, we know as DVF, is making 13 new ladies' frames and shades for Google Glass. DVF Made for Glass collection will be out on the 23rd. You could, as a glass explorer, you can buy them at the official glass store or at netaporte.com. I'm not going to be sexist and say, Gina, do you want these? I'm going to say, Jeff, do you want these?
No.
I think having a designer frame on such a dorky thing. The problem is it doesn't. You can dress up a pig. You can put lipstick on it.
It's like, it's really nice, except for that giant thing.
I love these frames, but what the hell is that thing over your temple?
And how it makes you jerk your head all the time.
It would be really nice if the arms bent.
Yeah. Firemen can save lives using Google Glass or shoot around corners. You take your choice. It's been a great year talking about glass. I hope it doesn't go away. In fact, I would love to see Google make a big announcement at I/O, something like, we are now ready to start selling glass as a consumer product.
$200 look along with money I wasted.
Right, $200. Well, it make, but you know what? That's the price you paid for being able to be a glasshole a year earlier than the rest of us.
So should I wear my glass at I.O.?
Oh, well, right. Don't you? Hasn't ever? Didn't you last year?
No.
I mean, it's one of the few places that you can wear it and not worry about people not understanding what it is.
Right.
I always just feel bad that the convention center, like, every single person has, you know, at least five devices on them that's, like, connecting to the Wi-Fi.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Will they give out glass?
No.
Free? At I.O.?
Nah.
Look under your chair? What will they give out? What fun gadgets will they give out?
Somebody at Google told me that we'll be pleased. That's all I know.
That's good. Because one school of thought would be, you know, this is becoming a problem that a lot of losers who aren't really developers are trying to get into I.O. just so they can get the free stuff. And maybe we should knock this off and do like Apple does and just say, hey, this is for developers. You're here because you want to learn how to develop. That's what I would do.
T-shirts, isn't that enough?
Yeah. Here's a T-shirt. Get away. You know, there's lots of stuff. Well, it could be a Nexus 10. Could be long awaited, not delivered. Could be a Nexus 6 or whatever, the equivalent phone. It could be glass.
Glass, a watch, Android TV.
Watch, yeah. I started this off with watches. Is there a Google
Nest
watch?
Thermostat?
Oh, a Nest?
I'm just hoping. A Nest.
A Nest.
No, I mean, you've been able to buy a Nest for a while. I mean, it's definitely going to be something that's early.
Can I ask you a question? I remember this story. It went around that Nest was going to put ads on there. And then I remember Tony Fadell saying, we're never going to do that.
Right.
That was a bogus story, right?
It was. There were two bogus stories at the same time, which means I think Nest has a bit of a PR issue. I think it was in some kind of filing. And he said, no, maybe it's because it's possible. It doesn't mean we're going to do it. We're not going to do it.
Because everybody and their brother, several times this week on Twitter, on various shows, I've had to say, no, that wasn't.
There were two bogus stories, and you corrected
people believed
one.
It.
That there was a big second recall, which was only the bureaucracy catching up to the actual.
And that was another one.
And right after that was the story about ads.
Yeah. So both of them bogus. That's
people
a sign
are willing
of
to believe anything.
Yeah. Especially
you know,
about Google.
Jaron Lanier wrote a piece for The Guardian saying he likes self-driving cars because they'd be safer, but then of course going through all kinds of hand-wringing worry about Google. Do we want them to drive us?
Well, that's Jaron. I mean, Jaron, who was a virtual reality advocate very early on, has a very nice set of dreadlocks, has become an anti-technology guy.
Yes,
in
he's
recent
a nice
years.
Guy, but I damn well rather have Google drive me than Microsoft.
I have Microsoft in my car. I'm not sure really how happy I am about it.
Is that the system that puts you in the water?
No, that is not. That's QNX. That comes from BlackBerry's RIM. The Audi has QNX as its operating system. The Mustang has Microsoft Car.
Right.
And actually, the Mustang works pretty well. And the Audi's fixed, so there. I'm very sad to see this. Google is going to close the Texas factory in Fort Worth where they build the Moto X. One of the things I loved about the Moto X was it was a phone made assembled in the United States. By the end of the year, they'll be closing the factory. Of course, Google has sold Motorola Mobility to Lenovo. I had some hope that those 700 Texas workers who were assembling Moto X phones there would keep their jobs. I guess not.
That's a bummer.
I think that's so sad. And this is happening before the transition. Google's doing this. But, I guess that is actually not unusual now that I think of it. In the sale of a company, you often fire everybody.
You clean up your messes.
And then if the new company wants to rehire them, that's up to them. But I would guess that Google has already said to Lenovo, you want to keep this factory? And they said, no, fire them all, please. We don't want – because otherwise Lenovo would pay the severance and the lawsuits and all this. Exactly. So it's going to be the current owner that lays off. Oh, that's so sad.
Mm. It's too bad.
Weak sales, high costs. That's what they're saying. It is. At its peak, they employed 3,800 people. Today, only about 700. So apparently.
You say high costs, that's not surprising, but the weak sales, that's disturbing for another reason.
Strategy Analytics says Google isn't saying how many Moto X's were sold, but Strategy Analytics says fewer than a million. About 900,000. comparing to the Apple iPhone, which sold 26 million units in the same period. Of the, what of, is the, a of one of the 5S.
Worse.
Samsung would be even more. Really, I liked that phone. I think we're going to think back and say those were the days, my friends. Like that phone. I don't know. I guess the Moto X Plus One will be made in China like everything else. 12,000 people in the first day asked to be forgotten in Europe.
And by now, it is more than 40,000.
How does Google do this?
It's just ridiculous. And the among the many ironies is that they've only made Google more powerful, because now Google's going to be the arbiter of what's relevant, what's bad, what's this, what's that. Mm. And it's just ridiculous. It's really a scary, scary ruling. And there's no opportunity for appeal. It's done.
So something like 10,000 requests a day, just kind of boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. Well, how many takedown requests do they get from DMCA?
Oh, far fewer than that.
Far
fewer than that.
I mean, I hear you and I agree that the ruling is troubling, but I mean, Google deals with spam and takedown requests from big companies all the time. So I'm sure that
they've got to make a judgment, Gina. They've got to make a human qualitative judgment, not whether this is infringing material. Was this created by Disney or not? But this is instead.
I thought they could kick it back to the court, though, if it was unclear.
It's up to Google. There is no absolute right to have the information deleted. Google will have to weigh a number of criteria in responding to the requests, including relevance and time passed. This comes from an article in PC World by Jennifer Baker. Google, quote, Google needs to work out what a reasonable consumer might find outdated. This is not straightforward. And if they do not anticipate, they will have too many requests. What a mess. What a mess. Now, I am a little sympathetic because, I mean, there's stuff I would love to be forgotten on the internet.
don't we all have that?
It doesn't have to be untrue. This is something very important to underscore. It can be true.
It's rewriting history.
Right. I mean, if it's untrue, you have recourse with libel and so forth. You can go to the source and say, that's not true. You have to take that down.
Well, somebody asked, too, whether they're, you know, somebody suggested in a comment when I wrote about this that one step that should have been in here is to demonstrate to Google that you went to the source to try to get it down there. And failing that.
That would be good. Did you try the guy who posted it? Peter Hustinks, the European Data Protection Supervisor, is happy with Google's online form. He says, yeah, Google is organizing itself, which is welcome. I don't know what country he's from, because ruling means the search engine needs... That was just a generic Eastern European accent. The ruling means that the search engine needs to anticipate what the reasonable expectation of a consumer might be. Hoi gavolt, that's a terrible
thing. What I really want to see happen is that a link to a site gets pulled down and the holder of that site sues.
Oh, great.
On the basis of... I want to see a ballast to this decision. And I want people to try to sue to protect their free speech.
The right
now,
to
course,
remember.
As we discussed on the show before, it's not going to be in the U.S. So all you have to do is go search on Google. Switch to Google.com, not .de or .fr, and you'll find anything. This is only holds in the European countries.
Yeah, I mean, what somebody needs to do is build like a extension or a bookmarklet that actually highlights the results on Google.com that have been forgotten on other search engines, because that'll highlight things of particular interest. But in terms of determining relevance,
that's a good idea. This is,
right, and it would be easy to do.
Google.
no longer on Google.fr or whatever.
Oh my God, that's a great right? idea.
No one can do anything about that.
Service.
I mean, it would certainly make those results. I'd love to know what's been, you know, struck from European search engines, and that would be pretty trivial programming wise. But in terms of determining relevance, I mean, that's what Google does, right? Like, that's what Google does every day in every search.
But it does it automatically. This is going to be a team of people who will review every request.
Yeah, the guy who caused the case, and as John Oliver said, now the only thing the world knows about is the thing he doesn't want to know. So is his foreclosure years ago relevant? Well, what the hell does it mean relevant? Relevant to whom? If I'm going to hire the guy, I wonder if I can trust him or not. If I want to give him a loan or go into business with him, yeah, it's relevant to me. If I want to go out on a date with him, well, maybe it's still relevant. But if I want to,
so there will be
sell him my skis. No, it's not relevant.
It will be removed from
contextual.
You have to be in the EU, and it will only be in the EU versions. The search results will still be available in other jurisdictions, including the U.S. There will be a notice at the bottom of each page that will say, "This was removed under the Right to be Forgotten Act."
Oh, that'll make it really easy to do what Gina suggests then. All you've got to do is do a diff between those two pages then. Right, Gina?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. Thank you. That's great.
I mean, it's literally just like get an array of URLs, and compare them to the array of URLs that you get on the other. It's a double request. Anyway, I didn't mean to start. but yeah, it would be pretty trivial.
Google has shared information about what kinds of requests they're getting. 31% of the requests were for fraudulent or scam incident reports that they want removed. Of course, if you are a fraudster, you would want that removed, but just, I don't know if that's in the public interest. 20% are reports of violent or serious crime arrests. 12% are for child pornography arrests. So more than 63% of these are for crimes.
Well, there's a different attitude. In the U.S., we take people who've been arrested but not tried yet on perp walks in front of news cameras.
Yeah, we do, don't we? Yeah.
In Europe, they put, they block the eyes. Though if you block my eyes, would you still recognize me?
Oh, yeah.
After you've served your sentence, then you can have something expunged in Europe. And you can, in some cases, in the U.S. as well. You can have a record expunged. But the fact of what you did...
This is fitting. You know who's on the board, the advisory board, that will review the process for Google? Jimmy Wales.
Yeah.
Who himself has a few things he wanted removed. Eric Schmidt, David Drummond, Google's legal counsel. Frank LaRue, who's a UN special reporter on the promotion and protection of the right of freedom of opinion and expression. Peggy Valky, director of the University of Leuven Law School. Jose Luis Pinar, the former head of Spain's Data Protection Authority. Jimmy Wales, and an ethics professor at Oxford, Luciana Floridi.
They didn't ask us.
Didn't ask me.
You want to
fill out the form? Let's fill out the form. You want to just ask for something?
Well, if you're going to go do something, did you watch the John Oliver thing on?
We should play that. It was very, very good. I thought it was the best.
If you want to go to some effort, fill out a form to the FCC.
That's right. Don't fill out this form. John Oliver did, and we won't play it today, but I will refer people to John Oliver's very, very good description of the net neutrality proposals by the FCC, which he called it, what was it? I can't repeat the phrase he used, but cable company effery.
He said the internet's not broken and the FCC is going to fix that.
Yes. Really well. Well done.
He said, trolls of the earth. He gave it a great funny thing on trolls. He said, now is your opportunity to use your skills for good. Go troll the FCC. And indeed, they did so much that it tore down the FCC's comment servers.
Oh, I'm not sure that's a good response. Sad to hear. But good on you, John Oliver. It took him a while, but a couple of weeks after the proposals. Yeah, there it is. It's on YouTube. Search for his new show, Last Week Tonight. And his segment on net neutrality.
It's a very, very good segment, folks.
Yeah, and it is HBO is posted.
Pass it around, please.
Yeah, I've got a lot of tweets and so forth. Preventing cable company effery. I love John Oliver, and I'm glad that he did that.
Leo, if you're in the EU, would you submit to the form the things that you would wish the internet had forgotten about you?
On principle, I would bite the bullet and say, but I know somebody who would. And on principle, I would bite the bullet and say, look, you know, but I also understand the other side. A close friend has spent a lot of time and effort to put other stuff up on the internet so that search results from Google don't point exclusively to negative reports.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I understand the human motive. I just think that the court didn't balance the rights of knowledge, free speech, and memory.
Well, my feeling is if it's untrue, pursue libel. If it's true...
Well, that varies country to country. In the U.S., that's the truth. Well, you're right. You're right. You also have to prove damage and you have to prove other things.
Right. Well, there's damage. Well, anyway, yeah, okay. I think those are reasonable standards. If you could prove it's untrue and there's damage, then that but the laws exist for that. If it actually happened or there's no damage, I think there's no right to pull it off the internet.
So forgetting child pornography and debts and things. I mean, if you look at, like, you know, the Snapchat founder or Zuckerberg saying things when they were 19 or 20 years old that they wish that the internet had forgotten, right? Like having to apologize as men now for being like teenagers and teenage boys and talking in a way that most teenage boys would just talk in a locker room and there wouldn't be a record of it. Right. But these folks are very successful founders now
but is it irrelevant, this is sort of on their record. Gina, to if our judgment of them as people, I mean, I think we've had this discussion before.
Who among us doesn't have regrets? We all have regrets about things that happened in the past.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But life does not provide a mechanism to erase those things we regret.
But I wish I could go to some people on the internet.
No, life didn't. If it was public, it was public.
But before the internet is a particular kind of memory that has never existed before, right?
I mean,
people would tell stories word of mouth, right? Yeah. It was a different thing than having a file that lived, you know, out there forever, right? Like, our technology isn't built to deal with information and passing information, saving information, and forgetting information the way that we collectively do as a culture and a community, right? I think that's the issue, is our technology doesn't forget. We do forget. So we're in this weird space where somebody, you know, a photo of someone as a kid doing something stupid looks just as real and current and up to date as, you know, who they are today. And like, I get what you're saying, Jeff, of course. Like, I'm not going to hold Zuck accountable for saying the things that he said when he was 20 years old. Although I got to tell you I didn't forget about that. I mean, I forgave, but didn't forget. You know, I mean, there was a time when
Gina, that's the key. It's what you do with the knowledge you have. It goes back to what Dana Boyd taught me. It's not the gathering, it's the use. And what you're doing is you're deciding when to be tolerant, when to look past, and when to find an openness to the knowledge that people make mistakes. And that's what society has to do. Internet or no, we've got to be able to forgive people for screwing up, because we all do.
Right. But if Zuckerberg – but it's about a time, right? It's about time that's passed. If Zuckerberg had said those things now, it would be a huge problem for his company, right? But because he said them a long time ago, but people remember them.
Well, what if I said something racist?
Mm-hmm.
I hope I haven't. But what if I – and then I wanted to run – 40 years later, I run for office. Is that relevant? It was – see, this whole relevance test at the time, you know – right now, is it relevant? Google can take it down? No, the guy's not a racist. It's been 20 years. Oh, fine, take it down. Then suddenly I'm running for Congress. Should I?
That's a good question.
And
a lot of people would think
it's relevant. And history has been erased. And who erased it? People who had – this is another digital divide. It's people who have the sophistication to go in and do these things.
You know, it's funny. 61% were for to pull down criminal – activities. 39% were from a William G. Gates who just wanted people to forget that he ever posed for this picture.
But see, that's cute and charming and a Snapchat. So I mean, I saw Peter Dinklage's, you know, mullet high school yearbook picture. It was funny. It was cute, right? But like,
yeah, but Peter might not think it's so cute or funny, right? He might not like it. And he'd have the right to have you forget it.
But I think things like racist remarks or... It's tough, and I often feel like I wish that our technology didn't automatically, by default, remember everything perfectly, because our memories don't. So there's a.
But again, I think we have to. What we have to do is figure out as a society what to forgive and when to forgive it. And trying to rewrite history is not the way to do it, because it creates a precedent and a tool that has been used by tyrannical governments to rewrite reality.
It's such a tough one. This is such a tough one. I don't think there's. It's so hard.
And it encourages intolerance.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I hear you.
Mm-hmm. Although I gotta say, when pictures of you are posted on Reddit that look like that, it's cute.
Come on, tell me that's amazing. So somebody posted Lannister in the front and Dothraki in the back.
God bless you, Reddit. God bless you. Now there's something he's guilty of. He really is guilty of. Somebody said, I love it. Let us. I'm just looking what else we have to talk about. So much, but I think we're kind of running out of time here. YouTube is also weighed in on the net neutrality issue. Of course, they'll be one of the companies that will be asked for money from ISPs who want to start a fast lane. And so they have released a U.S.-focused version of their video quality report, which lets you check which ISPs produce the best-looking YouTube streams. So I can see here...
oh.
Wow. That after... wow. Looks like it starts to really go up in the afternoon. And by 9 o'clock at night, that is a lot of video consumption right there. He says users on YouTube HD Verified Networks, though this is something new, HD Verified, should expect smooth playback most of the time. Compare providers in your area. That's so Comcast is HD Verified. Obviously, that means YouTube's paying them money, right? AT&T,
yep.
UVerse, SonicNet. Very interesting. Now, the clear point, and this is a point, of course, John Oliver makes in his show, is that over 90% of Americans only have two choices for internet service. It's not like you have a choice to go somewhere better. Amazon's going to have a device launch. We mentioned this. They put out an invitation and an announcement. Come June 18th, we'll probably be covering this in Seattle. A 3D display of some kind. According to Recode, it's a 3D phone display. Now, I thought that the rumor that Amazon was going to do a 3D phone seemed very far-fetched. But apparently, that's what we're going to see on the 18th. Amazon is not sending out invitations, but inviting those who want to attend to apply. Now, watch the people using whatever this device is.
Whoa.
That's really cool.
Turning their heads.
It's very real life.
In other news, Amazon released a video where actors act like they're looking at a product.
Yeah, this is really neat.
Whoa.
Something like that. Oh, my gosh, that's crazy.
That's super awesome. I don't know how you guys do it.
It's pretty flawless and seamless.
Wow.
There's one guy's pivoting on his hips.
How does it
like
do that?
Whoa. Yeah.
That's pretty good. That I'm impressed. That's pretty damn intuitive.
That's really cool.
Pretty damn intuitive.
Charlie Rose come in and say, "Whoa,
whoa, by drones."
Chad, you're exactly right. There was a great piece in the New York Times this last week about Harvard Business School, and I think it was Clayton Christensen got in a room to record a lecture for online education. He looked around and he saw that the students were attractive. No, really attractive. And he finally just asked, you know, are you students? Oh, no, we're actors.
Wow. Wow. I think, really an innovation here. They're posted on the Amazon.com / launch event. You request an invitation.
Where is it going to be held?
Seattle. Would you request an invitation, and I'll fly you out there. And then say, I want to wear my glass during this.
I'm flying enough, man.
Who could we send up there, Jason? You want to go to Seattle on the 18th? Jason should go.
Yeah,
we'll send Jason. Yeah. You have three choices. You have, are you an Amazon customer, a developer, or a journalist? And then you can do an optional video submission saying why you should attend.
Jesus, why you want to go to a FLAC event? God.
And it's right on the front page of Amazon there. Would you want an invite to a new device we're unveiling? This is going to be the phone. Look at the edge of it.
Yeah.
This is a phone.
No, based on what Amazon did to Android in the Kindle, I'm never buying an Amazon phone.
And really, I don't know why you would want a 3D display on a phone. What I mean?
Oh, so I can go like this.
So Jesus' eyes can follow you.
Yes, there you go.
I'm looking at
you. Imagine wearing glass and using that.
I think that's all we're going to do. Unless you guys have anything important, because we still have our tool and tip and number, and Jeff is exhausted. Let's talk about Full Sail University, and education is so important. And if you want to have a good career in our modern world, it would be very smart to become, especially if you want to be a marketer, proficient at web-based tools and techniques to reach audiences and consumers in a digital environment. Web-based channels, search technologies, analytics, SEO, all of these things. Full Sail University offers online courses towards an internet marketing master's degree covering these technologies: SEO, social media marketing, web metrics analytics, online consumer behavior. You'll be working in a great environment with real projects and real clients with industry experienced instructors. So this is not some pie in the sky. This is real-world experience. Full Sail University, they've always offered campus degree programs. They have online programs now centered on real-world education and experience with industry, technology, and workflow. And you can earn that master's in as little as 12 months. Through Full Sail's Project Launchbox program, you'll also receive a MacBook Pro preloaded with Apple's line of creative software tools, as well as degree-specific sets of pro-level applications. In addition to internet marketing, Full Sail University offers a variety of master's degree programs in fields like business intelligence. What a great skill that would be. Innovation and entrepreneurship, new media journalism. Full Sail. Learn more about them and their master's degree program in internet marketing at fullsail.edu/twig. fullsail.edu/twig. Set your sail for success. Gina Trapani has an Easter egg tip. I love Easter egg tips.
I know. I'm a sucker for Easter eggs. They're not the most useful things in the world, but they're fun. And Google's always got a bunch of them. There's a new one in Google Maps that tells you how long it will take to travel by Loch Ness Monster. you have to search for directions from a certain Fort Augustus to a certain castle.
Urquhart Castle in Dromadrochita Ivranes.
And, thank you, Leo.
Yeah.
Yes. Och. Och, yes. And then there will be a little egg in the route options area. If you see, if you click on route options, and there's
where,
an egg.
Where? Are you doing it or am I doing it? You're doing it.
I'm currently doing it. Do you want? I can.
Well,
it.
I'm currently doing it too. You so there. Do it. Best route. So what do I click on? Best route. Fewer transfers.
Less walking. Less walking.
Let's do less walking. There's an Easter egg right here, and I can go via Loch Ness Monster. What the heck?
28 minutes.
Oh, in fact, if you click the Easter egg, you'll see other ones that you can see. So it's 28 minutes by Loch Ness Monster.
Dragon, I think.
I would like to go by Dragon, please. I wonder if Google Earth would actually show Nessie on that trip. No, apparently not. So you'll be going, is that Loch Ness? You'll be traveling from Fort Augustus to Urquhart Castle? Huh. I like it.
Yeah, I thought it was cute.
Hey, Jeff, wake up. It's time for your number of the week.
All right.
I'm glad you did this one. You should do this one.
I'll do this one. So Google, to its credit.
Is that Dragon?
Yeah, that's by Dragon.
Oh, my Dragon. God.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Where am I going?
You are going from Snowden to Breach and Beacons? I'm not sure. Not sure where that is. This is
Brecon Beacons.
From a Boing Genius Report article.
Snowden to nice. Brecon Beacons. Make sure you go through the best route, which is Dragon. Wow.
Wow. It's flyby.
It's straight.
It's straight. It's
as the dragon flies.
It's only 21 minutes. Flies. If you take a car, it's 3 hours.
Oh, take the dragon.
Yeah,
take the dragon.
Dragons, they're expensive, but they're worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little hard to read.
Self-driving dragon.
They're a little hot.
Wear your flame-proof underwear.
Well, I was going to say, wear your flame-proof gear.
Oh, boy. Go ahead, Jeff. Your number.
So Google, to its credit, revealed its diversity numbers. And fully confessing that they need to work on this.
To their credit, because they're not good.
70% male and 61% white. And more details in that. This is a constant conversation in my field as well, in journalism, where, you know, to try to, for example, encourage, I'm at a city university, to get more, for example, black males, Hispanic males in my field, and to get the diversity of viewpoint in there is very hard.
Yeah.
Given, and I imagine a lot of the minorities at Google are international minorities.
We don't have any African-Americans working here. We have extended job offers to several, but they keep saying no. I don't know why.
Petaluma. No thanks.
Yeah, some of it may be Petaluma. Yeah. But no, I think it is a problem in general.
Yeah, it is, and actually credit to Google to say this, because I think what it does, too, is it also influences policy and scholarship funds at schools and things like that, to say that you know, Google wants a bigger pool of talent to hire from, right, as do we, and it requires explicit action.
It starts, it starts in education, in opportunity.
Yes.
Good for them for publishing their numbers.
I applaud them, because the numbers did not, they were like, wow.
Yeah.
But if I think about it, I mean, I think that's probably how Silicon Valley is in general.
Yeah. When folks are saying, oh, that the TV show Silicon Valley, like there's no women. It's like, yeah, it's making fun of.
They even said that. They go to TechCrunch and say, now, guys, you got to keep your, they're at TechCrunch Disrupt. The male to female ratio is now 15% female. You're going to be careful now. You could lose your heads. There was a picture of the men's room or the bathroom line at WWDC.
Oh yeah, this is a classic. Well, yeah. I mean that's one advantage. The bathroom's always clean and empty when you're a woman.
This is the Worldwide Developers Conference last year, and then this year it was a little bit better. So this is this year. So nope, I don't see any women. No, long line though for the men's room. This year, the same picture, a little bit longer line here. Oh, here's the best one. This was last year.
I'm really happy this conversation is happening.
Yeah.
And I hope it continues to happen.
I'm glad that it's coming
from the top.
We gotta do better.
We gotta do better. And that's been widely sort of acknowledged, and this is part of it. And, I'm happy. I'm happy when people are talking about it.
Good. Me too. I'm really excited for my tool something that's been out on iOS for some time, and I've just now got it for Android, and I'm really happy. I think it's one of the best calendar apps I've ever used. It's called Sunrise Calendar by Sunrise Atelier. It is now available free on Android and on your desktop, which is kind of cool, too. So let me show you. I'll show you on my phone. I don't know how well. Can you see my phone? Yeah. It's got a very nice user interface. It's got month interface. It's got day. It's got week. It puts icons next to people's names and makes the links hot links. It puts in maps. It does a lot of very nice things, I think, that make your calendar very pretty and highly functional. These are all my invitations that I have not yet said yes to. Here's the week view. Just really nice. And what I really like about it, of course, it's very easy to use with Google Calendar. You just sign into your Google Calendar and it automatically populates. And they have a very nice web-based version of this as well. So if you go to the web-based version, which is calendar.sunrise.am, and this is free, by the way. You can connect with Google. I'm going to connect with Google. It'll download my calendar, and it gives you a really, I think, attractive month-by-month interface on your desktop. Almost eliminates the need for a desktop calendar app, frankly. I really like it. They've done a stellar job, I think, of giving you a calendar. So it's called Sunrise, sunrise.am, iOS, now Android, and desktop, too. That's my tool of the week. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here. This has been a fun twig. Jeff, thank you for, as always, making the extra effort to be here in a foreign land.
I move heaven, earth, and sauna towels.
Well, we're very grateful to you for that.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
And I hope you
That's
get to go to bed.
What is the week?
What time is it? It's 11 there, right?
No, it's midnight.
Oh, it's midnight. Okay, sorry. Well, we'll get you to bed because you have a speech tomorrow.
Bye time.
Please give everybody at the big Google tent our regards.
Will do.
Yeah. And Jeff, of course, is a professor of journalism at CUNY in New York on Times Square. You can also read his blog at buzzmachine.com, and his many books are on Amazon, and there is a Kindle single, Gutenberg the Geek. There's Public Parts, and What Would Google Do? Gina Trapani's biz is ThinkUp, thinkup.com, a great place to get insights into your Facebook and Twitter feed. What if analytics were for real people, she says.
You know, we're actually redoing that landing page, Leo, because it's terrible. It doesn't really explain what the product is. And Team ThinkUp was actually scrambling to get that done by Twig today.
Don't show it.
We didn't quite make it.
My ThinkUp analytics? I always like
That'd
going
be
through this.
Here's, That'd be
so
good.
If, when I go to my page, this is the kind of stuff I get.
I think a congratulations is in order, Leo. ThinkUp noticed that you had something very exciting happen.
What does it have a little thing?
Well, your photo changed.
It just has the change. This status update got 10 times the likes. 464 people liked that. Aw.
Yeah, that's a good photo right there.
That's nice. Still working on that. We won't show that.
Beta. We're still in beta.
It shows you your tweets and what people, you know, like. Actually, this is a tweet I might want to mention at some point. I've been having, remember I talked about how Oyster Books was suddenly billing me monthly on my Google Wallet? So I got in a chat with the Google Wallet tech support, and they said, well, you can't do anything. You better contact Oyster. Yeah, well, they said, contact Oyster. So I contacted Oyster. They said, no, we don't know anything about it. We don't use Google Wallet. I said, well, what am I supposed to do? So they said, here's Oyster Books solution was sign up for an account on Oyster Books and then cancel it.
Cancel.
And then we'll see, because they use Stripe, I guess, so they don't see any. Meanwhile, every month I get charged $10. So my point, I guess, is the Google Wallet is not a credit card. There is a credit card associated with it, but it's not a credit card. If it were, I could just say, well, stop it. And they would have to stop it, right? But you can.
Yeah.
But Google Wallet says, well, nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, that's a bummer. That's a bummer.
So I am going to call the MasterCard associated with my Google Wallet and say, can you stop it? But
and
if you didn't
money.
Use a MasterCard, you'd. And the problem is my Google Wallet is tied to Google Music and my app purchases, so I can't just get rid of my Google Wallet or not fund it.
Right.
You can not fund your wallet, then it won't. I'll lose other things.
It's crazy how hard, like, credit cards are so hard. We have so many credit card failures. It's still so hard to manage this kind of thing. Like, even with great tools like Stripe and Amazon Payments and Google Wallet, like, you still run into these weird situations where it's like, what is going on? I'm sorry, Leo.
It's fine. It's $10 a month. It's not killing me. But at the same time, it's something people should understand.
It's the time and it's the irritation.
No, it's fine. It's not even that. I don't care. I let it go for 3 months before I even kind of made any effort. $10, but you should understand that you are vulnerable if you're using Google Wallet.
Yeah,
they can literally throw up their hands and say, yeah,
we got
contact
nothing.
The company. What if it's fraudulent? What if it's not a real company?
Okay.
Can't help you.
Yeah, that's a thing.
That's not right. I was shocked when the rep from Google Wallet said, yeah, no, we can't do anything about it.
Well, that policy might be changing. Fine.
It's shocking, but I guess because the way banking regulations work, it's not a credit card; it's a debit account. It's not protected. Oh, back to ThinkUp. I love ThinkUp.
Thank you, Leo. And our front page is actually going to explain what we do a little bit more, and that'll probably be up tomorrow.
The best way is to look at somebody's analytics and see all the things you learn. I mean, I tweeted 20 times last week, and I can see what my number one tweet was. And I mean, it's just really great. Who follows me? What verified users follow me? And my favorite one is, you know, your retweet garnered somebody 500,000 more viewers. Yeah, I like that. I mean, it's powerful. All right. Thank you, everybody. It's been so much fun. Gina Trapani, smarterware.org is her blog, which she never posts to because she's busy making ThinkUp better. ThinkUp.com. There is To-Do Text. That's great, too. That's her great to-do list for Android and iOS. Thanks to Chad Johnson, our producer, who works very hard each week figuring out what we can talk about. And thanks to you for joining us. We do Twig, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 2000 UTC, every Wednesday afternoon right here. I hope you will stop by and watch live. If you can't, though, on-demand audio and video is always available after the fact at twit.tv/twig and on our apps. There are apps for every platform. I say R. I didn't write them. We don't write them. We have wonderful third-party developers who take a lot of time and effort to write those, and we thank them, a tip of the hat to them. And, of course, on iTunes and everywhere else podcasts are aggregated. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next time on Twig.